Are you interested in VA ECMO? Maybe you've been hired into a unit where you see ECMO patients, but don't feel like you have a really strong base of training and understanding these patients. Well, you should check out the Intensive Care Academy. That's our other educational project at ICU101.com, where we've got lots of educational videos on all sorts of critical care topics, and we've just dropped a monster of a lesson on VA ECMO. Everything from understanding the circuits to understanding when to use it, how to wean it, how to troubleshoot it and prevent complications, and all of the tricky physiology involved. Check it out if you haven't. There's CME available as well. ICU101.com. On to the show. Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world. Hello, everyone. It is Brandon back here with Brian.
Hey, everybody.
We're going to have a little general chit-chat today, kind of exploring a role or an activity that a lot of people may not fully understand, something we've been doing more lately and on the lightning rounds, which I think is relevant for those who might want to consider doing some of this themselves, but is also just sort of general interest to anyone who is curious, because things are a little outside the beaten path of everyone's everyday job is always a little interesting to everyone. So the topic today is going to be international medicine and kind of service abroad. Some people might call medical mission kind of work. Basically, when you're going outside of your usual hometown to help out, to provide medical services, to teach, things like that. Usually this means overseas, but this is something that some people do with some regularity, some people not at all, and some people just sporadically. But either way, interesting stuff. So we're going to hear from Kwame Boateng, who is a nurse practitioner, works in critical care, and does a lot of work with SCCM, including in this area. And he's going to help us kind of feel out this topic. Welcome, Kwame.
Hello. Glad to be here. Thank you so much.
Kwame and I go back a number of years, and we spent a good amount of time in Chicago at the SCCM Congress not too long ago talking about global health and international medicine, whatever you want to call it, right? It goes by lots of different names. And I said, you know, it'd be great to have you on to talk about this, because I think this is something for me. I've always had an interest in global health and stuff. And one of the things when I first kind of started getting into this was I found it hard to get involved because I didn't really know what to do, who to talk to. And then there's extra dimensions for APPs. And we want to kind of focus on that a little bit today too, because, you know, PAs, NPs, we don't even exist in some countries. And some people don't know what to do with this. And I feel like this is an area that for our physician colleagues and even nurses, right? I've done stuff abroad where they've said, I don't know what to do with you, but can you be a nurse for a week? Sure. Right. Because those are more kind of recognizable roles. But before we get into that though, Kwame, let's just talk a little bit about like, what are we talking about? Like, what is global health? What is international, whatever you want to call it? What are we talking about?
Assuming I think everybody will have probably different approach of how to define it. But like Brandon said, it's really stepping outside of your normal territory or your place of service and going beyond that. Most of the time, I think we are looking at it more from the perspective of low resource countries or places that may not have the same sort of like opportunities. But on the other hand, keep in mind that those who are also in low income countries or low resource countries will look at global health as an opportunity of also advancing. So when it comes to high income countries, that's also an opportunity of their global health. So I think it really boils down to ultimately medicine spreading beyond just your comfort area or your natural home to anything beyond that. And I think that really has to capture every aspect of what medicine is about.
I think a lot of times we have this idea that is, in at least in my experience, pretty wrong. Certainly in application, but also just in conceptualization, that what we're going to do is we're from the United States, the best country in the world, right? We have the best system, we have the best resources, we have the best people, and we're going to go help these poor people who aren't Americans. And I think that's, maybe it's a good, decent motivation to get you off the couch, but it's pretty bad in terms of how you actually conduct yourself.
That's very true. Right? You know, I think a lot of times most people see it as us going to actually change what people, how other healthcare providers are providing care. But, you know, what we lose sight of is that in medicine, truly to ensure that you're able to get to the end of improving outcomes, it's really being adaptable, right? Being adaptable. And so in countries that I have, you know, had a privilege to serve there, as much as sometimes we highlight the outcomes not being great, yes, though, they are very smart, very knowledgeable in how they adapt based on the resources that they have. Those are things that we don't, in high-income countries, don't even think about, right? So for us to be able to make a decision about when to give patient fluid, you know, we are looking at the monitors, we are looking at all these things that we use to guide us. But in some of these areas, they are so adaptable and so great in looking at, you know, just how to use the vital signs, how to use the physical exams to truly manage a patient in critical state, which we don't even, there are some providers in, you know, in high income countries, they don't even touch patients when they walk into the patient's room, you know, but in those areas, you know, just the physical exams themselves should tell you enough. And so I definitely agree with you. It's never so much about us changing them. I have always looked at it from a perspective of it being very much of a collaboration. I learned a lot when I worked with my colleagues in low resource countries and vice versa. My job is not so much to tell them how to serve or take care of their patients, but what they probably may not be thinking about. Remember, everything is about, you know, most things are about exposure. If you've not been exposed to something, you may not think about it. And so it's really about just, you know, opening their mindset to think about, have you considered A, B, C, or D? An example, we have a research work that we are doing in one of the countries. And where we at now, based on the data that we collected, we saw that like 92% of the patients that were intubated ended up dying. And so one of our focus now is really looking at how we can help them identify what were probably the gaps, what was probably the cause effect. And so we studied most of the patients that were, you know, that died, looking at the mode of the ventilator, the settings, through the course of the duration in ICUs. And so now what we are working with them is trying to reason through some of the ways to augment the management on the ventilator. Because sometimes it's really, you know, based on the research and the guidelines that we produce, it comes across very black and white of how things should be done. But in medicine, there's always a gray area. And so trying to get them to think about the fact that maybe the issue is not the FiO2, it's not just increasing the oxygenation, but really, how can you properly recruit this patient? Or how do you realize that this patient may need to be intubated earlier than maybe the day or two before, I mean, after? So that early rescue sometimes is more like a waiting game. And sometimes too, it's not so much of, you know, something that's it's beyond them, such as if they don't have enough ventilators present, if they don't have the resources to be able to ensure this patient gets a bed in the ICU, because most of these settings have very, you know, not more than 10 ICUs in their hospitals. And so sometimes it's that resource constraint that also impact on the outcomes as well. And so basically, it's the collaboration of trying to work with the team members and say, how do we all think outside of the box?
Yeah, I could see how it would be very tempting to go somewhere with the mindset of, here's the right way, we're going to help people do it that way. When in reality, not only may you have very little idea what the right way is there, I mean, you may not even know what sort of patients they're seeing or what problems they're facing. But the real resource you can bring is probably not to make them identical to you, which is not possible, but just to sort of use the additional resources that our systems have to provide useful insights for them. For example, you've been had a chance to do some research or do the QI projects or make some errors. They don't have the resources to go through that process, but maybe the findings, the conclusions, the lessons that you have, you can give to them, and maybe those are still useful things. In other words, you know, you've sort of had the money and time and resources to burn to get there, but in the end, you end up with, you know, maybe similar goals.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the appreciation comes when they recognize that they still have ownership, right? Which a lot of times when we go there with the idea that we are going to help them change the system, we sort of like put them behind the sort of like this the table behind the table, and so it's more about what we want, not so much about what they truly want. And I think all for many years that has been one of the biggest gap in global medicine. It's mostly being directed by key stakeholders, those who have the funds, those who have the ability. And it's not so much of it being from a perspective of us really being collaboration, in a sense that it doesn't matter what funds you have, but truly speaking, you know, I think my message have always been that COVID taught us one of the best lessons, that whatever happens in Africa can also happen in America, right? And so when we look at it from that perspective, it means that if I'm traveling and I get sick somewhere that is a low resource country, I should be able to still get the same care that I may get if I was in the States. And so that collaboration with me and my colleagues working in low resource countries has to have that mindset that it is a collaboration. We are working through things together. We are thinking through things together. Your voice matters. You actually have to guide us through how we do this. And it has to really come from a very bi-directional perspective, where we are not only just going there to learn and support, but vice versa, how we also ensure that they're also able to get that exposure in our settings and see how we also do things as well.
Mm-hmm. I know one thing, when I went to Haiti a number of years ago with a disaster relief organization after one of the big earthquakes, and I was talking with one of the people who was on the ground there, and most of the people that were there for a year or more, right? So they were long-term folks. And I was just for a week, right? Most of the, there were teams, various teams that would rotate through for a week or two. And the majority of them were not medical. They were things like, you know, there was some people there who were agriculture people who were there to kind of help with crops. And there were people there who really didn't have any necessarily any specific skills. They were just there to like help tear down buildings that were half destroyed and build new ones, right? They could swing a hammer. And one of the guys that was a long-term guy that was there said, you know, one of the problems that we see down here with the short-term folks who come in is they have the best of intentions. They want to help, but they don't necessarily bring anything special to the table. They come down, they could swing a hammer. And he's like, but meanwhile, there's dozens of people here in Haiti who can swing a hammer. And he said, so they're coming down here and doing this work for a week and then they leave. And so the building's not finished. It's a job half done. And so it now has to sit there until I can either get some local folks to come finish it or until the next group shows up. And it's really very inefficient. And he said, you know, he was sort of arguing that people coming on short-term trips are really not helpful. And he said, I'm not going to tell them that because they enjoy it. And what happens is they go back and they talk about what a wonderful experience they had. And people will say, well, we should give money to support that work. And he said, so for that standpoint, it's good. And he said, I think the exception is when medical folks come down. And he said, I mean, I'm not just saying this because you're a medical person, but I think you guys can show up for a week and make a real impact. And I was feeling really good about that, right? I was like, this is, yeah, we can. And then the next day I was at a little roadside clinic and this woman shows up with malignant hypertension. I mean, 300 over 200. And I had to, like, I'm in a tent. I can't treat this. So I had to take her down the road to a hospital where she got some, I think, nifedipine and came back that afternoon to say, you know, hey, thanks, I feel so much better. And her blood pressure was normal. And I was like, this is great. We did a great thing. Until one of the doctors I was working with said,
yes.
Yeah, what does she do next week?
Yes.
When you're not here, what does she do? And I think, we can come in and do great things for a short term, but
and Brian, that's why my approach of global medicine changed over the years because I was doing short-term missions like that. I used to actually go to Nicaragua prior to getting married and having kids twice a year, you know, setting up clinic, and we would see thousands of patients. We would give them all those medications. But then the question is that after 30 days of that supply, what happens next? And some of these, community members were walking quite a bit of a distance. And so ultimately, when I really wanted to drive the ship, my approach was that it has to be relationship, education, and collaboration of empowerment. That means that, you know, if there is no relationship, there is really nothing that we can do, right? Because ultimately what happens is that we go to some of these areas and we don't even have a relationship with them. So we go and try to say, okay, we are doing A, B, C, and D. But to be honest, to truly make a true impact, it needs to be rooted out of having a relationship with the people. And so usually my approach always is before I come to a certain place, and most of the places that I've gone to, it's always been grounded on long-term relationship where we've talked through the process multiple times, developed key, you know, who do we need to be having conversations with, the chief medical officers in whatever, which hospital we are working with, even leadership within the community that we need to be working with. But over time, we build relationship before we actually deploy it ourselves to go into the place to do the educational training. And the reason why I love the aspect of the educational training is because you are empowering the people to be able to carry the mission forward. Mm-hmm. And even with education, there has to be a different mindset and a skill set because you are teaching from what you know from the high-income country. And so you need to be able to bring it to a place whereby it actually relates to them. For example, if they don't have a CT scan, you can't be teaching them about, you know, traumatic brain injury and doing a CT scan. You know, so this is where you engage them, you know, what are the resources that you have available? And hopefully based on that relationship, you know what is available. So you tweak what you are teaching from that perspective that you could do this if you have a CT scan. But if you don't have a CT scan, these are the other ways you could potentially manage the patient. That actually brings them and makes them more engaged. They feel like they actually are part of the training as well. And then ultimately, the collaboration, which is really, you know, building things together. And that's why the research aspect of it is also important to me when I do this work, because I actually have a set plan over 5 years when I do this work in most places, where we start off with a lot of education and then we have to enter into research, meaning this is the time that they need to understand how that knowledge is translating to their practice, how it's changing patient outcomes, and then ultimately taking the leadership to say, these are the changes we want to do.
I spent a little time in PA school in a clinic there. And, you know, one of the things I found, and I think this is a common misconception, is that a lot of people will go abroad thinking that they're going to see a lot of weird medicine, different ailments, different pathology, and it's almost sort of fun and glamorous in that way. And I mean, yeah, places are different, maybe infectious diseases, different occupational exposures, things like that. But I mean, a lot of the things you see are going to be the same diseases we have here because, you know, humans are the same and it's going to be, you know, hypertension and back pain and, you know, myocardial infarctions and things. And a lot of the work you're doing and the way it's different is not the diseases, it's the resources. It's the barriers and limitations to getting the things. And I think that kind of frames the problem more usefully because we understand barriers too. I mean, we have some of the same challenges here, maybe just to a different degree. Yes, we can fix your blood pressure for a little while in the ICU. Now what? Do you have a PCP? Do you have insurance? Can you continue to have, same kind of system problems and obviously the same challenges to long-term solutions because we can't fix that whole system overnight. We can just patch it up. So when you think about it that way, it kind of brings us all together. We're all facing the same problems. It's just different barriers in different places. It's not so much like you're going to Mars and treating Mars diseases. It's like, humans are pretty similar.
And I love what you just said, Brandon, because again, I think if you have that thought process, it actually does humbles you, right? in how you really work with colleagues in low income countries. Because a lot of times we think that we, especially for us who practice in high income countries or being exposed in high income countries, we feel like we are not, you know, at risk for these challenges, but we also have the same problem. Just like you rightly said, maybe just based on different degrees and the lack of resources or the sort of like the educational background that we all have. But it doesn't mean that the same problem doesn't exist in these areas as well. So it's really changing our mindset that, yeah, we also have the same problem. And one of the things I love about that relationship is exactly that, right? Being able to expose that to colleagues in low, middle-income countries saying, yes, we also do have the same problem. We also have problems with bed constraints. You know, we also have problems with not having, you know, enough nurses or not having enough physicians at night. We have these problems as well. But these are the reasons why things like putting together an advanced practice provider practice really started, where there was these gaps in not having enough, you know, physicians. And so this structure needed to be created. And the same way, how can we help you work together to create something that can actually help you in the middle? And maybe that opportunity may not be there, but then can we advance the nursing training in a way that they can actually really be more empowered and be able to have more voice to be able to work with the physicians in a way that is not so much of a hierarchy, because in most places it's very much a very hierarchical sort of like process. So let's change the mindset. You know, if the physicians are complaining that we don't have enough doctors, then let's empower your team members, which is the nurses. And then all of a sudden, after a couple of years, man, we just love our nurses. They are making decisions. They are helping us doing this. They are, you know, they start to see the difference. And it's not changing anything that they have. It's the same things they have, but just showing them that it is possible when you look at it differently.
Well, and I think too, you know, I think you mentioned earlier, there's things that we can learn from, like you said, the high income country folks who go to the low income country to work. There's things that we can learn as well, right? It's not just us coming and bringing our knowledge and our tools and stuff, but we can take back. And, you know, I used to know an attending, he was a hospitalist, and he could go in and look at a patient. He had worked for years in remote places like Africa. He could go in and sit down and look at a patient and, you know, you know, he'd pick up, look at their fingernails and be like, oh, this guy needs calcium because his calcium is this and this. And, you know, the residents would kind of roll their eyes and he'd check and he'd be like within a point of, he's like the lab. He's like, their calcium's 4.5 and he'd be right on. And the residents were always like amazed. And, you know, how do I learn this magic trick? And he's like, it's not magic. You just have to do it. You have to do it a lot. And I think historically we've sort of kind of, whatever, right? We don't need to do that because we have all these fancy tools. But I think in this era of where we start worrying about resource utilization and, you know, do patients need six labs a day? Do patients need repeat CT scans left and right? Do patients need all of these other things? We're trying to keep costs down. Or even, you know, I think in those of us who have been around longer than the last 4 or 5 years will remember there used to be a time where you didn't have shortages, right? And now every day, every time I go to order something, they're like, that's on shortage. So you can't have dilaudid pushes because we're short of them. You have to use fentanyl instead. And I think so often in the States, we have this mindset of, you know, oh, we're out of this. How am I supposed to treat people? And I remember like when I was in Haiti, we would run out of something and the local doc who was there, he would be like, I'll go to the pharmacy. I'll find something else. And he would just go to the pharmacy and get a different drug that maybe I didn't even know. I'd never used it before, but it does the same job. Right. And so I think that's something that we could learn from this and sort of take the idea that just because we can do something doesn't mean we necessarily should.
The other learning I think can be in having exposure to more advanced presentations of a lot of diseases, because we have gotten better at, you know, treating and preventing a lot of things earlier here. And part of what that means is that the more severe kind of progressed manifestations of a lot of illnesses are really rare, to the point of, in some cases, being almost sort of hypothetical, like you only ever saw in a textbook. And then, you know, you go to some other places and that may be more the norm because they haven't had the care earlier on. And so that, I mean, I feel a little bit weird about that because it's like a zoo. I mean, someone's suffering because of that learning. But I think that there is a loss to us in that the vast majority of things we see are very mild forms. Mm-hmm. And then we don't have a sense for the spectrum of it that you would have, you know, 100 years ago now and when they were writing these textbooks.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what Brian was also highlighting was about the whole physical exams as an example. The appreciation of the things, and I always talk to my residents about this, especially since I do a lot of nights, you know, Q2 ABGs. Do you really need ABG every 2 hours to make a decision, right? And then what I teach them is walk to the bedside and look at the patient. You know, really touch the patient, mm-hmm. examine the patient, let that be the driver of your data. You know, so the ABG is an augment of what you probably want to add just to see if you need to continue making these changes or you don't need to make any further changes. And unfortunately, I think we have created a system that because we have all the resources and all the tools, we think we should. But it shouldn't be the case. And I think that is the appreciation I always love when I love taking my APPs with me and my residents with me to these areas because obviously in those areas, you don't get a chance to say we are doing an ABG every 2 hours because they may not even have an ABG machine, you know? So how do they identify if a patient is hypoxic? Mm-hmm. You know, look at the data, look at their physical exams, look at, you know, the pulse sats. All those should give you some idea of how to truly manage the patient. I think we don't realize how much we shorten ourselves when we neglect that bedside physical exams exposure.
Well, and as someone who just this week ordered Q2 ABGs, that's someone I feel personally attacked right now.
it's called confession. It's called confession, man.
yeah. Forgive me, Father, for I've sinned.
It's like it's that Zentensivist approach. Like you discover that, you know, how much you can do without. And certainly, you know, you can do 90% of what you do with far less resources and data. And yeah, sometimes it's worth going for that extra little bit. But it's a little liberating to realize that you can get by with much less.
But, you know, the beautiful thing is this, man. The more we do this, I think you all probably appreciate the fact that the body itself is always going to try to treat itself. It's always going to try to fix itself. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times we feel like we have to do so much to get the patient well. But that's really not the case, you know. And so if we can just understand exactly what is needed, how can I keep augmenting and keep helping this patient to get better? The body will do most of the work. And I think that's why physical exams is so important as a true foundation for every patient. But by and by, I think, you know, you have even, you know, so many people that do not even know how to listen to the patient's lungs because they are not used to it, right? They don't even know how to listen to the heartbeat. Mm-hmm. They don't even know. There are so many things that we are taking for granted because we have the tools to be able to tell us. It's good to have an echo. I love using the echo at the cardiogram, but, you know, you can still find out how the patient is doing from the volume standpoint without an echocardiogram.
Yeah, I mean, we've even seen that recently in, you know, some of the big guidelines where they talk about just looking at cap refill, right? Cap refill is something that I learned as a nurse and then hardly ever used. And now, hey, that's a good idea. Just feel the patient's feet. Are they warm? Are they cold?
That's so true.
Well, so I want to transition a little bit into a little bit more practical stuff. Let's say people are out there who are listening and they're like, hey, this sounds great. I would love to do something like this, and I don't know where to start. How does somebody get involved, particularly, like we can talk about nurses and physicians, but like I said, I think it's a little easier for them, particularly APPs, nurse practitioners, PAs, and nurse practitioners, right? We're obviously nurses too, but, you know, a lot of people say, well, I want to do what I do now, right? That's my role. Maybe I've been away from the bedside like me for 10 years and I don't remember how to be a nurse anymore. So how does a, particularly, like I said, an NP or a PA get involved in doing some global health in a good way too? Because I'm sure there's lots of opportunities that you can sign up and it's just medical tourism, but in a good way that's helpful.
And so it depends. And the reason why I say it depends is this. If you want to do short-term missions where you go and put together a clinic and give medications and stuff, you could partner with some of these organizations that do that and just go along with them. But in my space of critical care medicine, what, you know, my advice would be how you get into that kind of space of using critical care medicine in low resource countries. The first thing you have to think about is that there are other key important things that goes on. One, if you are thinking about going to really practice at the bedside, that is challenging, and there's a lot of factors. One, you need to have some affiliation agreement. You need to have insurance that will cover you if there's anything that happens. And just those two things actually takes quite a bit of time. Insurance is also quite expensive. And so usually my advice is that if you are new to this, that may not be the first step you want to take, because that would just basically discourage you. Mm-hmm. So the other aspect of it is what I always encourage people to do, which is either focus on the educational aspect, right? Teaching. The teaching is much safer. You don't need any insurance. You don't need to be at the bedside. You can put together a classroom and just teach. It could be as simple as EKG. It could be as simple as, the ventilator. It could be as simple as just teaching them about medications for shock and the various presses. So education doesn't require all that insurance and all that affiliation. But if you are really new trying to start this, it's always safe to partner with someone. Always safe. Because again, you want to make sure that you truly understand the culture. You understand the sort of like the approach of how they approach medicine. I remember many years ago when we went to one of the countries in East Africa, a group had already come there and had created a lot of issues because culturally there were certain things that they were not supposed to be saying, certain things that we're not supposed mm-hmm. to be doing. And they did exactly that, the things that they were not supposed to. So they totally neglected the fact that there are certain culture things. Like, for example, in this particular country, you don't actually talk about death in a sense that this patient is not going to make it. Let's stop, let's withdraw care. It doesn't happen. There is an approach that the physicians in those critical care space do take, but it's never about withdrawing care, right? And so if you come from here and you go and talk to, patients and families there and say, we just need to withdraw care. We need to stop everything we are doing. Most families will find that very offensive. And so I always believe that you can connect with someone that's already doing it. But like, if you remember what I said earlier, it starts with a relationship. So you have to find someone you can also relate with in the country that you are going to practice or teach. Now with time, you can then build on other segments of what you want to do. And that's what we did. We started off with that relationship, and then we went and taught for a couple of topics, and then gradually started to build on the various topics that we're teaching. And then gradually we moved into the space where we could actually be with them at the bedside, running with them, being part of their discussion during taking care of patients without us being the primary people, but we are in the space to be able to have them we can serve more as a consultant and have discussions about, okay, why do you want to do this? Why do you want to do that? And then now also move into the research space and say, okay, these may be certain gaps that we may have. Why don't we, dig a little bit deeper through some quality improvement or some research approach? And so if that person does not have anyone they know already that does that, especially in their healthcare institutions, in their hospitals, if there's not a global medicine space or an office of global medicine that does this, definitely can reach out to me. I would love to help. But it always starts with having someone that you can actually work with, partner with. There are people that have been with me for many years that have now ended up doing their own work in other places. And that's kind of like the hope, is that we can bring people on board, get them that exposure, and then they can serve in other places that they may have connections to it. I have had a chance to serve in the West Bank and went and taught in the West Bank close to Gaza and everything else, because we had a relationship with a colleague that was from that area and built on that, you know, because again, that is another example of how the culture is very different. The territories are very different. In that entire area, you know, the systems is so intense. The approach is very different from when you're taking care of the Palestinians versus when you're taking care of someone from Israel. And so you have to really be very considerate how you approach what you are doing as a healthcare provider.
It sounds like if people are interested in doing this, finding an opportunity is not, there's not a super standardized way to go about it. It's not like finding a job, you go on ZipRecruiter or whatever, and here's all the things. It's more sort of local and individual programs that individual people or institutions have set up in specific places, and you know about them, or you know the people, or, you know, again, if something at your hospital, that's easy enough. But otherwise, I mean, like you said, even the work that SCCM has done, maybe people can just contact you directly. It's not like so much like there's a form or that kind of thing.
Well, you know, with SCCM, we have tried to do that. So we have a global outreach keg, which Brian is part of. And, you know, we have colleagues from different places, India, Pakistan, Africa, et cetera. And we have a lot of these discussions about what is happening, what are the things that we need to focus on. So that is even another way to expose yourself, because through that, you actually will get yourself connected with, you know, last year I was in India. I never thought I would go to India. But I was in India because I have a colleague on the Global Keg said, hey, Kwame, I really would love to have you come to India and give a talk, you know, on certain things that, you know, you've been trained with. And so I think it's necessary that you join a professional organization. That is definitely one. SCCM is definitely a place, if you are in a critical care space, definitely a place to be part of, and definitely a place to get involved with some of the Global Keg. There's plenty of room, and I'll tell you this much. There is plenty of room. As we speak this very moment, I have, I think, 4 trips I'm supposed to be going to in October, and it's actually a little bit too much for me, right? But, you know, because I have to also work within my workspace and also my family time as well. And so I think for me, the more we can get people involved with this, it helps the global health system in general.
For those who don't know, a keg with SCCM is a knowledge education group, which is sort of just like an interest group. So if you're a member of SCCM, then you're able to join any of these kegs. But
and we'll put some information in the show notes about that for people who might be interested. But Kwame, let's talk real quick about a couple of things that I think are big perceived barriers from people getting involved. And the first would be cost, because a lot of this is not. It's not like you just say, well, I'll go volunteer and it's taken care of, right? Like you have to pay stuff, right?
Well, and never mind your time. It's not like, here's my rate.
Right. Yeah. It's not cheap to fly to India, for example.
Right.
And we're dealing, like you said, mostly with people in low income countries who can't say, hey, Kwame, it'd be great if you come give us a talk. We will pay all of your expenses, right?
That's
to
right.
get here. So how do people afford the costs of these things?
Yeah. So, if you are starting off, you probably the reality is that you are going to have to self-fund this, which that's what I do. It is expensive for flights, but when it comes to the lodging, it really boils down to, for me personally, as long as it's a safe place, I'm good. But then there are people that sometimes when we travel with, they will say, Kwame, where's the Marriott? I'm like, it's down the street, it's $200 a night, and that's definitely not a place I'm going, right? And so, yes, cost is definitely a barrier. Now, some organizations and some healthcare institutions provide grants to support their clinicians to do this. And that is one of the other reasons why we do the research component of, well, you know, the global health is because, you know, with the research, then it opens doors for you to be able to apply for certain grants in maybe small organizations. SCCM is one. They will help small seed grants. There are other professional organizations like AANP, which is the American Nurse Practitioner Group, does have small seed grants that you could apply for. And so it depends on what their aim is with the grant. There are opportunities that you could apply for grants, but again, most of those grants is really for the work you are doing and maybe the flight, not so much even lodging. And so I think, you know, there are small seed grants that you could do. Now, if you self-fund it, the good thing is that if you are working within an organization, like as that is helping you to do this, most of them will provide you credit as that for you to be able to use it to even, you know, sort of like demonstrate your record for your file, your taxes and stuff like that. So you could get some tax return for doing that work. And so it may also be a benefit at the end of the day, even if you don't have any grants to support that. But usually it's self-funded. I think average cost for most of this work on a given trip, if I take a week trip, it's probably costing me close to $3,000.
And I imagine people could view it as like giving to charity in a sense, meaning it's you're not looking for your return on this money. You're spending it because you think you're doing something valuable with it. And also, I would imagine this is a good opportunity for crowdsourcing, fundraising kind of things. You know, if you go around, maybe people would want to contribute.
When I first started, I did quite a bit of GoFundMe. When I first started doing this, and I did it because I had a colleague that was very good at doing it. And so I was like, yeah, please do it. And they raised funds for us to pay for our first flight. And so those are definitely opportunities that sometimes you could also take to try to decrease the cost. I know for, you know, when I take nurses with me, most of the time they're able to get some scholarship within their healthcare system, to help support them a little bit as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know even when I went to Haiti, there was a local restaurant who would do these kind of spirit night, I guess, for lack of a better term, for different organizations. And like, so, you know, the local high school PTA would have one to raise money for the band or whatever. And I just called him up and said, hey, listen, I'm going to Haiti to do disaster relief for a week. Can we do one of these nights? And they were like, yeah, that sounds great. People love to help support stuff like that. Yeah. And so that, so I just put all over, you know, social media, hey, if you're looking for a place to eat dinner Tuesday night, go here. 10% is going to support my trip to Haiti. And, you know, I mean, I didn't cover the whole trip that way, but every little it's bit something. Helps. So yeah.
Yeah.
The other thing I want to touch on as a barrier and something that you sort of mentioned here with terms of lodging is safety. Because I feel like a lot of people are like, that sounds great. But like when you said Gaza, there's a war in Gaza, right? At Congress, somebody asked me if I would be open to go into Ukraine. And my first thought was, yeah, that'd be awesome. And then I was like, oh, wait, there's a war in Ukraine. Like, Ukraine. You know, but even if we're not talking Gaza and Ukraine and war zones, I think there's a lot of fear. Particularly if people, you know, I'm going to say the states, but also other high income countries who have not gone to low income countries, or if they have, they've gone in a very, you know, like, oh, I went to, you know, Thailand and I stayed at a 5-star all inclusive resort and never left. You know, this idea of, you know, I'm going to go to India, I'm going to go to Thailand, I'm going to go to East Africa. And is it safe? Even if it's not a war, is it safe for me to go to these places? So what would you say to people who say, I would love to go, but I'm scared?
Yeah. So your answer is the relationship. If you have a relationship established with any of the local providers, most of them will be very honest and say, maybe this is not the right timing. And there's been time that I have had trip booked out to even places that I've gone before, but then they felt that there's, you know, we are getting close to our election and it may not be the timing for you to come into the country, because nobody knows exactly what will be the outcome of the election. And so I think, you know, that's why, again, I'm going back to the first point of, if there is no relationship, do yourself best by connecting with someone that already has an established relationship. Mm-hmm. Don't go into a country without not knowing anyone, with that mindset that you're actually going to be able to do something when you get there. I think you put yourself in harm. And so the best thing to do is have a very good relationship established so you know what is safe and what is not safe.
Yeah, like what, one more reason not to view this as some sort of adventurous thing where you just toss your stethoscope and your bullwhip into a bag and sail off to some country,
yeah.
Both because you're not going to achieve much, but also because you just don't know what you're doing. I mean,
right.
If you are enough of an expert in an area to do that, you would already, you're not listening to this. People
right.
are thinking about something else. So, yeah. You know, get with an institution or a group or a program that knows what it's doing, and then you can rely on their expertise.
Yeah. And in the mindset, I think people have to realize that you can grow through this, right? When I started this, I had no, and you know, for example, when I started this, I did not used to put together a plan for a decision making between myself and the local institution, right? But now I do that. You know, I'm supposed to be in Goma in Congo in October, and we actually have decided on a 5-year plan. Why? Because I've learned over the years that if there is not a plan together, you may not ever see the impact that they would like to see. So at the end of the day, when you have a place that you've been going for a couple of years and they are coming, they are asking you, so are we really making a difference? And I'm asking them, what do you think? Are you really making a difference? They're like, well, we love all this training, but I don't know. Then I realized that, okay, I'm missing something here, right? So I've been teaching here for the past 3 years, but we truly don't have an approach of how we are, and we are able to target the outcomes. And it's not really about surveys, right? Because everyone can just say, excellent, excellent, excellent. So truly, how do you make that changes? And so now I put together a plan to say the next 3 years is going to be focused on this. After that, we are going to focus on this. After that, we are going to focus on this. And most of them will always say, yes, I like that, because I ultimately want to be able to justify that what we are doing is making a difference at the bedside.
All right. Cool. I think this has been a really great discussion. And like Brandon said at the beginning, maybe you're interested in this and you want to do more and know more, and we'll put information in the show notes of how you can get involved. And maybe you're just like, I don't know, that sounds fun and just interesting. But I think it's been a good discussion. So I want to thank Kwame for coming on and talking to us. Good luck with, you know, all your stuff. I like how you were like, I'm going to 4 different countries in October and it might be too much. you know, I'm been to 3 cities this month and it's already too much.
I'm supposed to be in Rwanda, Malawi, Congo. I mean, but we'll get it done.
All right. Well, I think that's a great place to end it. We want to thank everybody for listening and remind you that, you know, this is not medical advice. It's just general educational stuff. And we don't represent our various institutions. These are all just our own personal thoughts. So thanks a lot. And we'll catch you guys next time.